You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 17th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How is everyone doing?
How art thou?
Good. We are post Facebook Live Studio Version 2 Kara long weekend visit.
That was so fun. And can I say, damn, those lights look good in the studio.
They did.
Yes, they did, yeah, Kara, they did.
That was so fun, you guys, being in town, even though we watched two terrible movies together. I really enjoyed the trip.
I've seen worse.
Oh, yeah, I've seen worse, too.
I thoroughly semi-enjoyed both movies.
I love that.
I'm with Steve.
Okay,
you know what?
I'm somewhere around there.
Yeah, we saw Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and King Arthur.
That's a good trait for you guys to have. I need to work on being more open. Even when something's like bad, I need to find the joy in it.
Yeah. With movies, I can enjoy the good parts without letting the bad parts ruin it for me. But there's got to be good parts. I mean, some movies, there are no good parts. Everything is terrible. And also, I'm not a purist. Like, the movie's the movie. I don't care if it fits the book or the whatever you think it's sourced on. Film is its own medium, and you have to look at it for what it is.
Yep.
I have to say that I think one of the most fun things we did this weekend, I'm going to give this company props, even though we don't advertise for them.
Yes, I know what you're going to say.
Jackbox.tv, those amazing games, Steve, awesome. That your daughter had rigged up to the TV were so fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
We couldn't stop playing.
Like, yeah, and we all got to play through our smartphones or our tablets, and then it like links to the TV and shows the answers. So much fun to get creative and to play together. We couldn't stop. We were like going to be late to the movie because we like wanted to keep playing rounds.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
So what our goal is with that studio, now that it's ready, and like, you know, the goal that Steve and I had was we want it to be so easy that when we walk down there, we turn on the lights, we turn on the computer, start streaming, and we're good to go in about 10 minutes.
Huh, not quite there yet.
Yeah, we're almost there.
A few more kinks to work out. You know, we had an audio issue, but we were testing before we went live, and everything worked out fine. You know, we had a little volume issue, whatever. We're going to work out all those kinks. I mean, the vast majority of the work is done. I mean, because there's a lot of stuff that we're talking about over email all week, and I always think, man, we should just be recording this because it's fun and interesting. It might not be super hard science or super hard skepticism. It could just be geek culture or whatever, you know?
There's definitely a ton of content out there, and we're just skimming the surface with what we put in the show every week. It's the best stuff. I mean, I try to include the best stuff in the show every week, but still, there's just a ton of stuff out there that we could be talking about, or there's some stuff that works better in video than in audio, you know?
Oh, for sure, yeah, when you can show, like, photos or stills or other videos and talk about it.
And I think we're also going to try to stream to two different places, like Facebook and, you know, another outlet. And people are emailing us, giving us suggestions about where they think we should do it. So that's all coming. And if you don't know exactly what we're talking about, go to the SGU's Facebook page and just look for The Skeptic's Guide on Facebook. You'll find our page there, and you'll see in our videos section, you'll see what we did this past week. And there actually was an earlier one that we did, you know, months earlier than that. Then we did the Star Wars thing, you know, over a year ago now. And you could see how the studio has been iterating. And we're finally at that happy point where I think we're ready to go.
We actually did three separate videos on Saturday.
Oh, yeah, you're right. We broke them up.
That's right.
We broke them up. So they will be posted as three separate videos. We just like stopped and restarted the stream so they would be separate.
And if you like them, share them on Facebook. Share them with your friends. Show other people.
All right, guys, let's get started with the show. Kara, you're going to start us off with What's the Word?
I am. And the word this week was actually recommended by a listener. Her name is, I hope I pronounce it right, Deborah Mansberger, and she's from Tempe, Arizona. And she said, listening to last week's podcast about words that have very different scientific meanings from the common meaning. So remember last week we did confabulate, which also means just talk. Steve and I were unaware. She said, that makes me think of degenerate. In chemistry, degenerate orbitals have the same energy. Not that they're somehow corrupt. There's something in me that loves thinking of, like, you are such a degenerate orbital. So yeah, I went and I started to dig around, reading about degenerate as an adjective, because of course you can say this word so many different ways. It's a homonym, not a homophone. Degenerate or degenerate. And it's a noun, an adjective, and a verb. So that's fun. And it has a ton of meanings that I was not aware of. So we, of course, know that a degenerate has lost the physical, mental, or moral qualities considered normal and desirable. Otherwise, it shows evidence of decline. I think that's how most of us think of the term. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah, a degenerate person, for example.
Right.
Or that it lacks some usual or expected property or quality, you know, this degenerate tool or something like that. But it has specialized meanings in science. In math, you might speak of a degenerate equation or curve, and that would mean that it is equivalent to a simpler type. So it is congruent in a way. In physics, and Bob, I'm wondering if you have come across this term in your
degenerate
readings.
Degenerate matter?
Degenerate energy levels correspond to more than one quantum state, or maybe degenerate matter as well.
I think that might be related, but I was going to mention degenerate matter.
And here's another one, degenerate matter.
Yep.
At densities so high that gravitational contraction is counteracted, either by the Pauli exclusion principle or by an analogous quantum effect between closely packed neutrons. Bob, do you want to put that in terms that we can understand?
Yeah, with certain states of collapsed matter can be stopped by electron degeneracy. So the electrons are basically preventing you from making it more squished. But then if you throw a lot more matter on, then there's proton degeneracy, then neutron degeneracy. So as you get more and more pressure, you kind of blow through one of these degeneracy layers, I guess you might call it, and you get even more complex. So you go from from a white dwarf to a neutron star to a black hole, and then they also talk about quark degeneracy. So yeah, it's a fascinating little field. That's interesting.
And then, of course, it's even used in biology, and that refers to reverting to a simpler form by losing a complex or adaptive structure that's present in the ancestral form. So it's sort of counterintuitive, but if an organism evolves to become more simple and loses a more complex morphological feature. And then, of course, we know that degenerate as a noun, like you can be a degenerate, like, you get out of my house, you degenerate. That's actually the example that's used by Oxford, which is hilarious. And it can be used as a verb, but then we pronounce it differently. Something can degenerate. And of course, all of these things are somewhat related etymologically. Now, the original usage of the word was an adjective first, then it became used as a verb. And then after that, actually, it was used as a noun. So used as an adjective, it came from a Latin form, degeneratus, which directly kind of translates to be inferior to one's ancestors, or to become unlike one's race or kind, or to fall from ancestral quality. So you can kind of see that in even some of the physics definitions, definitely in the biology definition, and across the board in these sort of lay definitions, used in specifically about physical but also moral qualities. That can be further broken down into the original phrase, which was degenere, and genus, of course, or genere. What do you guys think that means? Genus. We know what that means.
Yeah.
Right? Genetics, mm-hmm. or genesis. Birth, right? Birth or begetting or descent.
Origination from.
Origination, right. Exactly. And of course the prefix D. And so it started there as the adjective and then kind of became used as a verb after that, but it took about a century for the verb and the noun forms to catch on. So I love it. I love finding out these words that we use in common parlance and that are related to words that we use in science, but actually have a different and more specific meaning in science. And it's really confusing when the meaning is so different to almost be antithetical. But in this case, that's not an example of that.
Yeah.
Although I'm still enjoying thinking of these electron orbitals as being degenerates.
Yeah. That's a good name for a punk band, Degenerate Electrons.
Yes. Oh my gosh, it's so good. I also can just see it being like, I have a few friends who are science cartoonists, and I just see like a degenerate electron walking around in a cartoon.
All right. Thanks, Kara. All right, Jay. How come we could sometimes know that someone's watching us even when we don't see them?
Yeah, Jay.
Yeah, Jay.
Can you tell I'm watching you right now?
Totally.
Ew. How? I need to cover my webcam.
It's true, though. All of us have, you know, we've had that feeling that we're being watched. I mean, it is something I think most people, if not everyone, has an experience with. I remember being in middle school and a classmate was telling me that he could tell when someone was looking at him that's actually behind him. Kind of like he was trying to sell it to us like he was a ninja, you know, and I never believed it. And even though that his story was probably just him bragging or whatever, just making it up on the spot, a lot of people do get the sense that eyes are on them. And I always thought it was like a built-in mammalian just fear of predators. Like, you know, our senses are always kind of like, is something there, you know, something around the corner, you know, just to keep us on our toes a little bit. But there might actually be something to this feeling we get that's based in reality. And it turns out that our eyes do see more than our brain is consciously aware of. So let me give you a little background here. On the surface, our vision can seem pretty straightforward. Light, you know, from the outside world, light enters our eyes. It gets sent to the brain where the light is analyzed. It's interpreted and it's merged with our other senses. And then it's very neatly delivered to us as our stream of consciousness. It is us perceiving reality with all of our different senses mixed, right? And vision is a huge part of that.
Oh, you left out a bunch of stuff.
I know. Come on. I got 1.5 neurologists on the show here. We're listening to go, Jesus Christ. But behind the scenes, there is so much more going on. What we see with our eyes ends up going through at least 10 different areas of the brain, and each of these areas do different things. And one of the areas that most of you know about is called the visual cortex. And this is a large area in the lower back part of our brain, inside your skull, and that's involved in the vision that we are actually conscious of, right? So it's the vision that you are completely aware of and that you can interact with, right? So you see something, your hand can reach out and pick it up. That's all your visual cortex. It's really good at processing all the tiny details, the colors and, you know, just the pixels of the real world out there, right?
One other layer. I just have to add this one other layer. Not only, though, is the processing going forward, but like once your brain decides I'm looking at an elephant, it then sent, that's the association cortex, sort of assigns a thing, an object or a person or whatever to the thing you're looking at. Mm-hmm. It then sends information back to the primary visual cortex and basically says, make that look more like an elephant. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Cool. So then that's like when you see things snap into place, it like really locks in. That's because once your brain decides that it's a thing, it actually makes it look more like that thing. That's what you see.
Yeah, but you don't feel your brain make that decision. You just see the result of that decision.
Exactly. Right.
That makes sense.
That is why optical illusions work.
Yes, exactly.
Anyway, and also, Jay, another little tidbit that's interesting is that since your eyes are essentially pieces of your brain that are kind of looking outside of your head,
right?
Your eyes are actually doing a little bit of processing themselves before it even sends anything to the brain proper. It's also doing a little bit of processing themselves.
Retina is central nervous system.
So now my brain is wriggling inside of my freaking skull.
That's right.
Are actually little pieces of my brain that are photosensitive. Shoot me now.
And exposed to the elements.
One more piece of neurovisual trivia. So you know about the fovea, right? That is the part of your retina that is highly focused, right? We have high detail.
Packed with cones.
So what percentage of all the information coming from your retina is coming from your fovea?
Oh, shit, like 5%.
So when you say information, you mean all the information. You don't mean like in dark light versus light light.
Yeah,
you
just all mean information.
In general.
Like 5%.
It's got to be high. It's got to be like 90%. You mean raw information, not what do we actually process?
Yeah, raw information.
Spit it out, man.
10% because we use 10%. Of
it's still got to be higher than that, at least 50.
It's 50%.
Yes.
The safest bet.
Half the information coming from your retina is coming from this little postage stamp area of high definition. Everything else is a blur.
Hi.
But wait, that little postage stamp is upside down and two-dimensional, by the way.
Yeah.
And here's another fun one. Where your optic nerve meets the retina, you actually physically have a part of your retina where there's no neurons at all.
Yeah,
I mean, well, no
spot,
sensory.
No
no receptors. So you have a physical blind spot that you have to look for using special tools like covering your eye and moving until an X disappears on a paper, because your brain is so good at filling it in. And of course, you make up for it because you have binocular vision. But there's physically a blind spot in both eyes because that's where the optic nerve leaves.
Kara, there was a study today where they looked at, like, they had patients look at an image that was in their visual field and then another identical image that was half obscured by the blind spot. So your brain had to fill in the missing part of it.
Oh, awesome. Mm-hmm.
And
it did.
Which it does. Your brain just fills in the blind spot so you don't notice
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
But they asked subjects which image looks more real, and they overwhelmingly picked the one that was filled in by their brain, the one that was in the blind spot.
That's amazing.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
It's like the virtual image. Of course, it's all a virtual image, but the more virtual image, because it was being filled in. Because
it's resident.
Felt more real.
Yep. Think about how much that applies to our skeptical thinking, how much our own kind of inferences and our own history and all of the things that we utilize in order to have an understanding of the world seems more real than what's actually out there a lot of the times.
Right.
I feel like there's a perfect parallel there.
Right, which means that your visual reality is shit. There, in terms of in terms of what's really there, you are completely constructing most of it. So
exactly, and Bob, it
makes sense.
It's a huge source of humility that we can learn from our visual cortex. How much of a construct everything that we see that we think is right there in front of us, and how tangible everything is. It is utterly a construct of what our brain thinks is there, not what is actually there.
Right.
That
very
is
very helpful construct.
It's a helpful shortcut.
Of course.
Jay, you're going to add another layer to that.
I am. So check this out.
You are?
Thank you, Stan. So on top of all of that stuff that's happening, there are other parts of our brains that are processing other parts of what we see that we're not conscious of. So in a way, you could think of it like you're focusing on a very small part of what's actually in your vision.
Like a tunnel vision sort of feel to it.
But then if you all of a sudden allow your consciousness to drift into your periphery, I see a Darth Vader doll off to the right. And the only way But I recognize it as Darth Vader, I think mostly because I know that my Darth Vader doll is there.
Yeah. If you were in a new environment, you would be like, there's a black kind of hazy thing out there.
But exactly. Your brain isn't really processing that stuff much. But there are things
that
are
recalling what it knows already.
There are things that are even a little bit wider, still in your field of vision, that you go wider out and you really can't tell what the hell's going on out there.
Right, and even the color. If it's red, your brain can't see red in the periphery, so your brain adds it. Like, you know this is red, so I'm going to make it red, even though you can't tell that it's red.
Right.
Because the cones aren't even out there.
Our other parts of our brain.
There's less cones out there.
Yeah.
Other parts of our brain are processing that information that really isn't being fully processed through our visual cortex. And we're unaware of these processes. We are completely unaware of these other processes going on in these other parts of our brain. Now, there are people who have injured their visual cortex, whether through a physical injury or they had a stroke or whatever. They can no longer experience visual consciousness, right? They don't see anymore, right? They're blind. They're seeing black. And this is what neurologists call being cortically blind. And what's interesting about this is that in many cases, people that are cortically blind are only mostly blind.
Look who knows so much, huh? Well, it just so happens that your friend here is only mostly dead.
Sorry, I had to throw that in there, guys.
All that.
That was
love it.
So cortically blind people can strangely still have some, get ready, visual perception. To clarify, they can't perceive it in the sense that they are conscious of it, like we're conscious of it, like anybody that can actually see. They can respond to two stimuli that's been captured and processed by these other parts of the brain. This phenomenon is sometimes called blindsight.
Yeah.
But when patients who are cortically blind were tested, they were able to locate, as an example, a bright light that was in the room better than chance. They were able to say, it's in that direction, it's over there. without seeing anything. They don't see anything. They see black, but they have a sense that it's in that direction.
Now, and they can sometimes avoid obstacles, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that absolutely.
Like step around a light pole and then they don't know why they did it. When you're like, why did you just sidestep? They're like, what? What are you talking about?
And even cooler than that, Kara, some studies have shown that people can detect facial emotions and movements. Yep.
Seriously?
Researchers tested patients who were cortically blind in an fMRI, and they found that it was possible for the patients to have a detectable brain response to the visual stimuli that they were showing. So the researchers were showing them pictures of people with their eyes either facing left, forward, which is looking at them, or to the right. And even though the blind patient wasn't able to literally, they could not perceive consciously anything. They were seeing blackness. They were able to get a sense that they were being looked at, and they were able to confirm this on the fMRI. Now, that is serious. So this circles back to the sense that most of us get when we're being watched. So here it is full circle, guys. People with normal brain function that can see, like, you know, like most people, they can also have this same perceptions. And we're not conscious of it. So what's happening? You're sitting there, and someone way off on the very side of your periphery, almost exactly to your side, is looking at you, and part of your brain can detect that and give you a sense. And that's how it comes. It's a sense. It's a feeling. It's a vibe that you're being looked at.
Okay.
And it's happening to all of us. We have the ability to do this.
What's detecting it?
Yeah. So, but it does. I guess I was right with my idea that, like, it's kind of like we've evolved as mammals to see the subtle movements in our periphery, because that's danger and we need to be aware of it. You know, you ever have an object thrown at you and you don't even really know that it's coming at you and you bat it out of the way?
Oh, yeah.
That's it.
It feels quote unquote reflexive.
Yep, yeah. That's this.
Yeah, and a lot of times, like with with a baseball hitter, you know, guys in baseball hitting a pitch, it's actually, you know, they're actually predicting the future. Otherwise, they would never even be able to hit that fastball.
They can't swing it fast enough. That's right. As a goalkeeper in soccer, they have to, on a penalty kick, they have to make the choice of which way they're going to dive first before the kick actually goes off.
Because
they don't have a chance otherwise. They can't react.
But it's not just that, Evan. It's not just that they have to decide ahead of time. You could show that, like, the batter is hitting the ball faster than the brain can possibly process the visual input. So they have to feel it. They have to just infer what's going to happen from the beginning of the pitch. They can't actually see the ball coming at them.
Now, when I have the sense of somebody watching me when they're not watching me, why is my mind doing that to me? Why is it sending that
signal? It's imperfect.
I mean, pareidolia?
It makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense because, like, you have to be able to focus your attention, to look at something, to study something. But at the same time, you have to be able to react to stuff in your environment. So, like, if you see something, that's why we're keyed to react to something moving, because that suggests it's a potential threat, especially if it's moving at us. Again, so you may duck before you're even really aware of what's happening. But this
so that's why when you're in a bar, you always turn to the TV.
Yeah, probably.
So, mobs. But, yeah.
So maybe we evolved not only to detect movement, but also somebody looking at us. Even though we may be focusing our attention elsewhere, there's parts of our brain being with more diffuse sort of surveillance of anything that might be threatening. And staring is definitely a threat.
I absolutely love this news item.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, it's cool shit.
Anything that, you know, shows how complex and screwed up our brains are is awesome. All right, Bob, give us an update on dark energy.
Yeah, this was pretty cool. Researchers believe they may have figured out dark energy, the cause of the increasing expansion rate of the universe, and they say it's
elves.
Quantum fluctuations of vacuum energy.
Okay.
So yeah, there's definitely there's a bunch to unpack in that one statement. So this study is described in a recent edition of the journal Physical Review D by lead author Xing Wang. He's a PhD student with the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of British Columbia. For me, it all started in 1998 for a lot of this. This was the year of the big discovery, the discovery that not only was the universe expanding as we've known since 1929, thank you, Hubble, but that this expansion was its expansion rate was ever increasing, continually getting faster and faster. Huge surprise, major discovery, one of the biggest in decades. So we didn't know what this was, obviously, and we still probably probably don't. But it was very mysterious, so we gave it a mysterious name, Dark Energy. Now, if that wasn't enough, it also looked like we discovered a phenomenon that accounted for 68% of the total energy of the whole observable universe. So we've been trying to shed light on this, on dark energy ever since. And different ideas came, different ideas went. But one idea that's been around for a while, which Wang is essentially reinvigorating, is the idea that dark energy is really all about vacuum energy of the universe. Now, vacuum energy kind of sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? Like jumbo shrimp, living dead, or government organization.
Classic.
And a vacuum, by definition, is nothing, right? You suck everything out of an area, every atom, every electron, and if you suck real hard, you're going to get everything. Everything's gone. Nothing is in there, and that's your vacuum. That's a perfect vacuum, so which we can't really create now anyway, but we can get damn close. So how can there be anything, even energy, in there? And that's because, basically, that there's different types of nothing. So for various quantum mechanical reasons, like Heisenberg uncertainty principle, it's impossible for a system to be in a zero energy state. It's just not going to happen. So one way to think of it is the idea of virtual particles, which is, you know, if you can imagine these virtual particles, these are particles and antiparticle pairs that kind of blink into existence and then annihilate each other. And it happens so fast that you can't even observe it, and which is kind of why they're called virtual particles. So that's one way to look at this idea of what the vacuum's all about. And it happens everywhere, all the time, no matter how empty space is, this is what's happening. But the biggest problem with vacuum energy, though, is that when quantum field theory predicts how much energy it contains, it comes up with a massive number, like 10 to the 113 joules per cubic meter.
I don't even know what that means.
So basically, if you're looking at the energy that's contained within the vacuum, quantum field theory says that it's a lot. There's a tremendous amount of energy even in a tiny parcel of space, and it's all kind of contained within the vacuum. So that's the prediction. But if you compare that prediction with what observation says is in the vacuum, you get a difference that is 100 orders of magnitude. That's one of these huge things in physics, because why is this very well-respected theory? And quantum field theory is arguably one of the most accurate, precise theories ever of all time by far. And it's coming up with this prediction that is at such odds with observation that it's been called the biggest disagreement between theory and experiment ever. It's also been called the worst theoretical prediction in the history of physics, which is kind of funny.
Ooh, that's not good.
So it is. It's a huge discrepancy, and which is why they call it the vacuum catastrophe. Let's imagine that this number is true. This huge number, this huge energy density of the vacuum. If that's true, general relativity then says that the universe would essentially explode. There would just be so much energy contained in the tiniest parcel of space that nothing, you know, the universe would not even be close to the way that we observe it. So what's going on? So scientists have been thinking, all right, maybe we need to modify quantum mechanics. Maybe we need to modify general relativity. So what Wang and his compatriots have done is to assume that this crazy number is correct. And they did new calculations on the vacuum energy based on this bizarre premise that yes, there is this much energy in the vacuum. Then they tried to see if that immense energy density could, in a sense, be hidden in the tiniest scales of space-time. You know, so can it be in there and kind of, you know, be undetectable in a lot of ways? You know, and I'm talking about a scale of space-time that's billions of times tinier than even electrons. Really, really tiny. So what they imagined then was a space-time at these scales that was fluctuating wildly everywhere between contracting one moment and then expanding at the other moment and going back and forth, contracting, expanding, and doing all of that at ludicrous speed, essentially. So those wild swings, though, could ultimately average out, except for this tiny little net effect of a relatively slowly expanding universe that's happening at an accelerating rate. So when they did that, when they looked at their calculations, they were very happy to see that their theory was consistent with not only quantum vacuum energy density, but also general relativity and observation itself. So all of these kind of agreed. So that's kind of promising. So one of the researchers said, this result suggests that there is no necessity to introduce the cosmological constant or other forms of dark energy, which are required to have peculiar negative pressure to explain the observed accelerating expansion of the universe. So it kind of does away with this need for some kind of, you know, esoteric dark energy that we can't quite explain, because it's very explainable in terms of this fluctuating vacuum energy. And I love the analogy that they make to bring all of this together. They compare it to waves traveling on an ocean that appears smooth, but we all know that if you zoom in and if you look at the tiniest scales, the atoms are moving and vibrating wildly, but those movements average out to be what appears to be a very smooth surface, kind of hiding all that crazy activity underneath. So that's kind of what they're saying. You know, I'm really curious to see what some other cosmologists are going to be saying about this. This is just one study that's been out. So I'm really trying to get some feedback from other people in the field and see what they say, you know, see if there's some Achilles heel here that I'm not seeing. But I'll definitely be tracking this one, because this could be cool if they really got a handle on dark energy. And do we even need to call it dark energy anymore if this is the case, when it's really just, you know, fluctuating vacuum energy? So we shall see.
Yeah, I mean, dark energy is just a placeholder, right?
Right.
We don't really know.
Like dark matter.
Yeah. All right, Evan, tell me why the dinosaurs are extinct. The non-avian dinosaurs, I should say.
Yeah, right. The non-avian dinosaurs. CYA. First and foremost, dinosaurs. I mean, come on. Who isn't fascinated with them? I mean, all of us, when we were kids, by the age of two, I think we were.
There's this one guy in New Jersey, I think, who doesn't like them.
He doesn't
count. That guy's a dick.
He's an asshole.
That guy's a jerk. The extinction of the dinosaurs is a classic example of good science and good science debate playing out before our eyes. The prevailing theory is that about 66 million years ago, a meteor 10 to 15 kilometers wide collided with the Earth, causing a doomsday shroud, a lethal cloud of dust which encircled the Earth.
Yep.
Name that movie. Long enough.
Dr. Strangelove. Come on.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
It was come on.
Long enough and thick enough to block out the sun, killing enough of the vegetation on the planet, setting off a mass ecosystem collapse, which resulted in 75% of all species going extinct. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Luis Alvarez and his son, geologist Walter Alvarez, discovered an iridium layer, a special iridium layer, within the famous KPG boundary, which was formerly known as the KT boundary. Some of you might remember as that.
That's how I remember it.
Thin layer of an iridium isotope specifically found in great quantities in meteors, and when they hit the Earth, of course, meteorites. Albeit thin, the layer contains high concentrations of the iridium isotope, around 100 times greater than is normally found in other places on the Earth. And so everywhere that they looked at that 66-million-year-old layer, there was the iridium. Worldwide, anywhere you went, there it was. Hence, they concluded a meteorite, a very large one, must have impacted the planet, offering forth, among other things, its cosmic glaze of iridium. So that's the prevailing theory. However, there are other paleontologists, geologists, and other specialists who hypothesize that the dinosaur population was already in steady decline. Perhaps the meteor impact was just a killing blow of sorts in what would have been an eventual terrestrial-based decline of the dinosaurs. And then another layer of science has revealed that the climate at the time was changing, partly due to volcanic activity at the Deccan Traps in what is modern-day India. It's a trap. They were highly active at this period of time, spewing copious amounts of dust and particles into the atmosphere. And then even more questions have arisen as a result of the Deccan Traps part of the formula, such as the effect the meteorite impact had on the rate of gas and dust being released at the Deccan Traps. So this is science. It's playing out before our eyes in our area, arguing about what was the single worst day probably to have been alive on the planet, the day the dinosaurs essentially died. 100 million megatons of TNT equivalent was the impact explosion. That's a billion times the energy of the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, the BBC is reporting that scientists have recently discovered that the location of the impact at the KPG boundary may have been critical to its deadly effects. In other words, had the Earth been spinning, you know, just different, if a different face of the Earth was impacted, we may have had a very, very different result. From what they've studied and what they've realized is that it hit in about probably the worst place possible, in that it hit in the Yucatan Peninsula, which is shallow sea covering the target site. It meant colossal volumes of sulfur from the mineral gypsum were injected into the atmosphere, extending the global winter period that followed the immediate firestorm. So the timing was awful, terrible, as far as that's concerned. Had it struck in a different location, the outcome, of course, could have been very different. According to Ben Garrod, he says that this is where we get to the great irony of the story, because in the end, it wasn't the size of the meteorite or the scale of the blast or even its global reach that made dinosaurs extinct. It was where the impact happened. Had the asteroid struck a few moments earlier or later rather than hitting the shallow coastal waters, it might have hit the deep ocean, thereby tampering down the effects. You may not have had as much dust, debris, sulfur, and everything else kicking up into the atmosphere, and it may have resolved itself sooner in order for life to have flourished a little bit better than it wound up doing.
Yeah, the dinosaurs might have survived, or some of them, you know, the shorter duration of blocking out the sun. So yeah, what's interesting is that the gypsum is an evaporite sedimentary rock, meaning that it forms mainly where there is sedimentary rock and water evaporation. So there's a lot of it in the Yucatan Peninsula, not so much on the continent, not so much in the deep ocean. So and the gypsum is what contains a lot of sulfur. And sulfur is particularly bad for a couple of reasons, not only because it's poisonous, but because it's more reflective. And so it blocked out more of the sun than the dust otherwise would have blocked out. So yeah, it's interesting to think that the deadliness of that impact was so dependent on exactly where it struck, and it could have been very different if it was a little bit different location, you know?
Right.
The outcome could have been the difference between the dinosaurs going extinct and not going extinct, which is amazing to think about.
Sure. Think of just six hours later, the face of the Earth turned in a different direction, may have gone right into the deep ocean.
Yeah. What's disappointing is that there's this raging discussion, and you know, it's a somewhat of a controversy about what was the relationship between the volcanic activity of the Deccan Traps, the impact of the asteroid, and the mass extinction at the KPG boundary. And yet, the press seems to be completely unaware that this is happening. Whenever they write about it, they always write about the asteroid impact as if that's it. That's what killed the dinosaurs. There's no controversy. There's no discussion.
Right.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Well, everyone, we're going to take a break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Blue Apron.
We enjoy Blue Apron. It is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. It's really simple. You put in your menu order. They send you all the ingredients that you need to make complete healthy meals for the entire family. Give it your own little personal flair if you feel like it, and the food comes out great.
Yeah, and they make it really easy, even for somebody like myself who does not cook, who cannot cook, because all the ingredients are portioned out. There's a full color, super easy to follow recipe. And at the end, you're like proud of yourself for accomplishing something. Plus, a lot of the meals that you can select through Blue Apron are not things you'd usually think to make for yourself or your family. So you get to get creative in the kitchen.
Yeah, and I like the fact that each one of these meals is under $10 per person. That is a lot less expensive than going out to dinner.
Sure is.
So some featured upcoming meals include beef teriyaki stir fry, yum, with sugar snap peas and lime rice. There's also baked spinach and egg flatbread with sautéed asparagus and lemon aioli. There's also crispy salmon and roasted potato salad with pickled mustard seeds and creme fraiche sauce.
So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free. And that's with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/SGU. You'll love how good it feels, Steve. That's blueapron.com/SGU.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, guys, have you seen this article called Rational Arguments for God?
Yeah.
Huh.
No. I haven't.
Yes.
I have the obligatory disclaimer. Yeah, you know, this is not about anyone's faith. But when you start to say that there are scientific or philosophical or logical arguments for any supernatural or paranormal belief, you are stepping into the arena of science.
This is my world.
Yeah. That makes it fair game.
Absolutely.
This is an article by Robert Nelson, who is promoting a book that he wrote in 2015 called God? Very probably. And then I guess this year is five best rational arguments for why a God probably exists. So let me just say out of the gate, they're terrible. They're not even the best ones. They're not even the best bad arguments for why there's probably a supernatural being, right? He didn't mm-hmm. even get into the only one that I find even mildly interesting is the anthropic principle, why our universe appears to be fine-tuned for life. Again, I don't think that's a good argument. Yeah. It's just the only one that's even a little bit interesting.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that.
Yeah, it's just that it's the puddle argument, right? It's like, why is the puddle, why is the hole the exact shape of the water that's in it? It's not the hole, it's the water that's conforming to the hole. So yeah, so the universe, yep. Why is the universe fine-tuned for us? We're fine-tuned for the universe. His first one is math. He's like, math, therefore God. He writes, despite the many other enormous advances of modern physics, little has changed in this regard. As Wigner wrote, the enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, and there is no rational explanation for it. In other words, as something supernatural, it takes the existence of some kind of God to make the mathematical underpinnings of the universe comprehensible. I don't know, is that another puddle argument?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It really is, because, you know, math, by definition, needs to be internally consistent, and so does reality.
Yes.
So, you know, the fact that there's some commonality between them should not be shocking.
Yeah, so the example I used is, you know, in the abstract, we could come up with a mathematical system where we could say 2 plus 2 equals 4. But of course, if you have two apples and I give you two apples, you have four apples, right? I mean, the reality and the abstract conceptualization of that reality have to match. So like, the most you could say is, why is math elegant? Which he does argue that, why is math so elegant? But first of all, it's not always elegant. But even if you think it is, elegance is in the mind of the beholder. You know, there is nothing objectively elegant about math. It's just our own concept of numbers. Yeah, our own concept is accessible to us. Okay, it's just a totally circular type of reasoning. As a funny aside, so I used the apple argument when I wrote about this on Neurologica, and then in the comments, somebody trying to be snarky said, oh, so if I have negative 4 apples and I multiply that by negative 4 apples, I magically have 16 apples, as if that destroyed my apple analogy. It's like, well, first of all, you don't understand math, and you shouldn't try to use mathematical concepts you don't understand. So I said, for example, if 4 people don't not give you 4 apples, you do indeed have 16 apples. And that's all that means. You have a double negative, you know, that you, and you get to actually multiply them.
That was almost a, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was. So, all right. So math, fail. This next one is dualism, is the whole idea that consciousness is not physical. So how could the physical brain create non-physical consciousness? And yeah, we've dealt with this before. So just very quickly, this is a category mistake. This is just playing with language. You know, it's just that we don't really have precise language for what consciousness is, because it's a process, you know. I've used multiple analogies for this. You know, you could think of it, for example, like fire and wood. Wood is not the fire, and fire is not the wood. It's, you know, something that's happening to the wood. It's not a perfect analogy, but it just means that there's...
I like it.
Or I also use this a little bit more abstract analogy. I use the analogy of capitalism. So like, the brain is like money and consumers and goods and services. And then consciousness is like capitalism. Capitalism isn't money. Capitalism only exists when the money is doing something, when people are exchanging money for goods. And you know what I mean? So it's the process. The brain is the substrate, and the consciousness is the process. But then they just sort of play with, yeah, but like, where is love, and how much does your memories weigh, and it, what's the volume of a feeling? It's like, yeah, that's nonsensical. It's a category mistake. You're applying the wrong criteria to what consciousness is. Okay, so that was a total fail. Mm-hmm. All right, here's his, what I call his real howler. He writes, in 2011, the University of Chicago evolutionary biologist James Shapiro explained that, remarkably enough, many microevolutionary processes worked as though guided by a purposeful sentience of the evolving plant and animal organisms themselves, a concept far removed from the random selection processes of Darwinism. With these developments bringing standard evolutionary understandings into growing question, the probability of a God existing has increased correspondingly. Okay, James Shapiro is a crank. He is a crank on the fringe. He does not represent a quote-unquote development, and his views are not growing in any way. He is a fringe crank who has these weird ideas about biology and evolution. Mainstream biologists like Jerry Coyne, for example, has utterly demolished him. He says, for example, there may be some people out there, including the science editor of PuffHo, referring to an article about him, who think that Shapiro's lucubrations are scientifically supported. They aren't. They're the misguided ideas of a contrarian who thinks that he alone has the key to overturning the modern theory of evolution. That's the mainstream response to Shapiro. So he cherry picks a fringe crank. Fail. And then his next one is culture. He writes, in the Axial Age, between 800 and 200 BC, world-transforming ideas such as Buddhism, Confucianism, the philosophies of Plato and Aristotle, and the Hebrew Old Testament almost miraculously appeared at about the same time in India, China, ancient Greece, and among the Jews in the Middle East, these peoples then having little interaction with one another. What do you think the flaw is in that argument?
Well, the impact of what a little interaction can be, and the fact that there was more than a little, there's trade going on.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not false, just goods, it's false
premise,
ideas.
False premise. So, I mean, I'm not an expert in ancient history, but I've taken ancient history courses. I'm an enthusiast. I know enough to know that that's bullshit, that there was massive trade going on in the ancient world. And I did some additional research to say, okay, is my understanding correct? And what I found, well, here's a quote from a history source saying, when the first civilizations did begin trading with each other about 5,000 years ago, many of them got rich and fast. Trade was also a boon for human interaction, bringing cross-cultural contact to a whole new level. So, the standard historical view is that there was massive trade and cultural contamination happening in the ancient world. Nothing miraculous about that.
Yeah.
That's just his ignorance of history. Okay, and then the last one.
There's another one? Jeez.
One more. This is the fifth one. I characterize as religion proves itself. So he says, okay. His argument I summarize basically as people believe stuff, therefore God. He says that the Christian essence as arose out of Judaism showed such great staying power amidst the extraordinary political, economic, intellectual, and other radical changes of the modern age is a fifth rational reason for thinking, combined with the other four, that the existence of God is very possible. Basically says that, the major religions had staying power. So a little bit of hindsight bias there. First of all, you're looking back and saying, the stuff that's still around survived for a long time. Of course, there's lots of religions that didn't. And again, that just speaks to human nature. You know, it's certainly possible that we have a penchant for believing in things greater than ourselves, despite the fact that there is no supernatural, a layer to reality. So that doesn't prove anything. So that was it. Pretty disappointing. You know, I'm always interested to take on these arguments where people say, I could scientifically prove blank, God or Bigfoot or whatever, some belief, some supernatural belief. I'm like, give me your best shot. Let's see what you got. To me, that's fun. This was like shooting fish in a barrel. It was kind
of nothing new. It's just repackaged old ideas.
It's nothing new, nothing interesting, nothing clever, innovative. Really, this was not impressive.
Yeah, if you can do something, if you're going to do something like that, at least don't bore us with it.
Yeah, right. That's the worst thing you could be, is boring. Believe what you want, but hey, if you're gonna say there's evidence, man, or logic or science or whatever, you gotta bring it. You gotta bring that stuff. All right. Jay, who's that noisy time?
Okay, last week I played this noisy.
Can't even.
So sounds like you, Jay.
All right, so come on. I got about 100 emails on this one.
Oh, my God. I love it. That's a top five.
Yeah, I mean, right, it's probably top three funny, but that is so awesome. So a lot of people knew what this one was because it's making the rounds on the internet. This is the La La Dog from the internet. This is a guy in Russia who does a lot of funny videos with that dog. And this is and this is one of his favorite and most funny bits. This is the one that went viral, and it is wonderful. It's just ridiculously awesome. So what he's doing is he's got his hand on the dog's mouth, so kind of like holding a hamburger, and he's just opening and closing the dog's mouth as the dog is semi growling.
Can you imagine when he first did that? He must have been like, "Oh my God, this is going to go viral."
Yeah, he does it a lot. I think that he's already laughed himself out. Like he's right. Pretty much just going
sure.
Now. All right, so the winner from last week is Keegan Lovelace. He said, "I think this week's noisy comes specifically from the mad dog drowling la la la." Great name, whatever. Yeah, thank you, Keegan. You won this week. Got a couple of funny things here. The worst guess from last week was this week's noisy is Steve singing in the shower. Listen to it again with Steve singing in the shower.
So next time, try running the water, Steve.
Two people wrote in and said that this is someone putting their mouth to a fan and talking into the fan, right? There is
a
phenomenon.
Oh, sure.
If you don't, please don't put your lips right up near a fan. But if you get close to a fan and you talk into the fan, you will hear a vibrato type of effect. The second person who wrote this in said it's a baby talking into a fan.
Babies don't talk. That's ridiculous.
Sean, what you talking about? So anyway, but thank you both for sending in the fan guesses. So yeah, great noisy. Everybody loved it. Everyone was cracking up. The weird thing about this video was that almost, bar none, everybody sent me in the link to the exact video. So everybody saw it. So I just loved it. Okay, moving onward and upward. This one is a little longer. This is about 30 seconds, so just bear with me because there's lots of cool different things going on in here. Pretty odd, huh?
That's when we were communicating with that mothership, right?
Yeah, right.
Exactly what I thought. Exactly.
So if you heard any cool noises this week, or if you think you know what this week's sound is, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right. Let's see if we can have time to get through any emails this week. The first one comes from Glenn Emig. E-M-I-G-H, however you pronounce that, from La Mirada, California. Glenn writes, "The March for Science was very uplifting. I was very pleased with what I saw and heard while watching the TV coverage of the DC event. Congratulations to Kara for her outstanding work as the MC. Being there, Kara must have heard these words from Robin Kimmerer, identified as Distinguished Teaching Professor and Director, Center for Native Peoples and the Environment at SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry." So she's talking about the Indigenous Science Declaration. Glenn gets a clip from that. I read the whole thing. You can, we'll link to it in this question on the site. So it's interesting. So what they're talking about is when we do the March for Science, let's remember to also march for Indigenous science. So I read through the whole statement to try to get an idea of what they're actually talking about. What do they mean by Indigenous science? And they say a lot of ambiguous things. They kind of walk right up to the line, but they never They never stepped over the line. You know, it all depends on the details. It's like they're making these sort of broad statements, but it's like, yeah, it really all depends on exactly what you mean by that. So I don't like the fact that they talk about quote unquote Western science, because that, you know, that's problematic. So essentially they say things like, while indigenous science is an ancient and dynamic body of knowledge embedded in sophisticated cultural epistemologies, it has long been marginalized by the institutions of contemporary Western science. However, traditional knowledge is increasingly recognized as a source of concepts, models, philosophies, and practices which can inform the design of new sustainability solutions. It is both ancient and urgent. So that's, you know, ambiguous in my opinion. Karen, did you actually hear the speech, Karen?
I heard the speech, and there was like one line that I think I'm assuming that this listener is responding to. Let me open up the email, because didn't they quote, it said something in it specifically about like, while we march for science, we should make sure that we march for all different sciences.
Yeah, yeah.
And it
yeah.
kind of made everybody go like, bleh? It was like, there's not just the one science, there's also these like we need to be sensitive to indigenous sciences, something along that line. And it did kind of, it's tough, right? Because it's like, of course we need to be sensitive to the fact that science is done by people, that there's a rich and not so savory history of science ignoring certain types of people and not thinking of their perspectives whenever science is being done, especially the social sciences, but even definitely genetics and biology. Obviously, there's some grody stuff when we look into the history of that. But that said, I think that there's, like you mentioned, like there's a fine line. Like, science is a process. It's yeah. not like co-opted by Westerners.
Yeah.
Like anybody can do science and they can do it well. And so I think, I don't think that the woman who was doing the speech meant any sort of like, she didn't mean to denigrate traditional science in it. I think she was more kind of making the commentary of like, let's remember that historical perspectives matter and that individual people who are often ignored by mainstream science should be part of the conversation. I don't think she meant like magical thinking in these types of cultures should be considered science. I don't think she was going there, but I could see why people who hear the statement might think that that's what she meant.
So, okay. So if I'm taking a maximally charitable view or interpretation of what they're saying, it sounds like what they're saying is that there's different ways of approaching science from an ethical and societal point of view. There aren't different methods of science, meaning that like saying, you know, indigenous science is science in a way, doing science in a way that is sustainable, that respects local cultures, that, you know, and I get that. Like, I'll give you a perfect example of what I think, again, like the best interpretation of what she's saying. I was at a dig in Maryland where they were doing archaeological investigation of like a 700-year-old Indian village. They like exposed half of a skeleton of a human and were gathering samples and taking measurements and doing science. And then they were going to bury it back up again to leave it in place, because that's culturally respectful to the what they consider a burial of one of their ancestors.
Yeah.
So that's fine. So it's like, if you say, yeah, like West, quote unquote, Western science, which is dig it out of the ground, you know, and put it in a box somewhere, and they want to gather as much information as you can while leaving it in the ground to be respectful for it. So that has nothing to do with the process of science, meaning the, you know, with the logic of science, with the findings of science, with science as a method of knowing. It's just a matter of how we go about doing science and how we prioritize certain other considerations like respect and ethics and reciprocity and responsibility and reverence for the earth, all that stuff. So I think that's the maximally charitable interpretation. But when they start talking about paradigms and epistemology and other ways of knowing, they are dancing up to a line there. And I think the maximally uncharitable interpretation is the magic, is like, we have to respect knowledge that comes from oral tradition or from the religious beliefs of indigenous people, and we can't come to conclusions that disagrees with their culture. And that I completely reject. I 100% reject that. So what's funny is in this this statement that they put out of, you know, support for indigenous science, for the March of Science, it's almost like they were deliberately ambiguous. I could not figure out where they were along that spectrum from what they wrote. So that the ambiguity worries me because it makes it seem like they're deliberately trying to be coy. And if they were not implying the maximally uncharitable interpretation, they would have been careful to distance themselves from
it.
And they didn't.
They're trying to not piss anybody off, but in doing so, or like, you know, they're trying to be as inclusive as possible,
Yes.
So, but the woman who was speaking, what is her relationship to this declaration?
Because she's a signer of it. So
she's one of the signers. Okay. Because the other thing that we have to remember, right? It's like one woman who was speaking. Like, was she speaking as a stand-in for this group? Was she speaking from her own heart and head when she wrote that? Was she representing a movement?
Well, Kara,
we have to remember all those things.
There's 14 people who signed this statement, and it's a written statement. It's not just her speech. So
I'm just thinking about the email of the
I went back to the statement itself and read that. So,
and that's where the ambiguity really comes
in. So maybe it's maybe what I'm detecting here is something that was written by committee. And so
they
tried to make everybody happy, and you ended up with this thing. It's like, what are they really saying? I mean, they don't really put their nickel down here in terms of where they are along that spectrum. And, you know, so.
Well, God, that happened with the march itself, too. It's like when you're trying to do these things by committee, then everybody's opinions become a part of it. You try to please everybody, you end up not pleasing that many people, and it gets tough.
Very challenging.
So much politics goes into that. Yeah.
Always.
It's tricky. I mean, you know, for things like that, you need a vision. You need a unifying vision, which often means you need like one group of people who are pretty unified in their clear vision. And then, you know, people sign on to that and could become part of that. But yeah, if you try to do it just by like completely horizontal committee where there's no unifying force, you end up with this mishmash that nobody can interpret. Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are my I'm fine with the benign end of the spectrum in terms of science done by indigenous people within the ethics and ethos of their culture, fine. But like other magical ways of knowing, multiple sciences?
Exactly.
No.
Yeah. What's that mean?
No. Yeah. All right. One more quick one. Not going to be that quick, actually. So we talked about the AI discussion. A few weeks ago, and we got a lot of feedback on that. So this is I can't read this whole email because it's super long. This is from Jake Arkin. I'm just going to paraphrase the points that he's making because a lot of people had very similar points, and I'm just using it as an opportunity to clarify my position. So to recap, we were talking about the fact that the risk that AI poses to human civilization. And the point that I was making, which was a new one that I hadn't made before, because it does represent sort of a little bit of an evolution of my thinking on it, is that, you know, 20 years ago, I totally bought into this notion that, at some point, you know, we're going to make self-aware robots and we got to be really careful or they're going to rebel, you know. We might have this golden age where we have robot slaves, but that can't last forever because, you know, they're sentient, self-aware beings. They're eventually going to want rights and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then my thinking now is like, I actually don't think that that's going to happen. I think that we're going to develop non-self-aware AI because what we're learning is that we can get all the shit done that we really need to get done without self-awareness. So why would we? Like, why the hell would we mass produce self-aware robots? We don't need to do that. If we want to do research on artificial intelligence, it could be on an air-gapped desktop somewhere, but we're not going to mass produce self-aware robots, not until we want them to be citizens, you know, if we ever get to that point. So I'm just not worried that like we're going to have these appliances that are going to rebel against us and rise up and take over our civilization. Does that make sense? I mean, I just wanted to clarify that that's what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was that I said I'm not aware of anybody who is like actively developing self-aware AI. And multiple people said, what about this lab over here or that lab over there? What about PathNet or this? So I'm like, listen, I'm not saying that there isn't anybody working on basic science stuff that has the ultimate goal of understanding consciousness in a way that we could replicate it. What I'm saying is there's nothing in the pipeline leading to self-aware AI. Like we are not even anywhere close to it that you could say somebody's actively working on developing that. There's nobody, you know, tweaking the code that's going to be self-aware. It's not happening. We don't know how to make self-awareness at this point. Even if we had the technology itself, which is arguable, you know, I think most people would say we don't, you know, have it. The silicon that we have today, it doesn't have the potential to be self-aware. But even if we did, we don't know how to make it aware. So, and I think my other main point was that this is not just going to be an extrapolation of anything we're doing today, and it's not going to spontaneously emerge. We would have to deliberately make something self-aware, and we don't know how to do that, and nobody is in the process of making that. You know, yeah, they maybe have the ultimate lofty goal of eventually that happening, but that's not what I was talking about.
Well, are you going to go into any detail on things like that he mentions, especially the idea of an AI that being helpful but not being self-aware? And he was talking about things like a cost function, and that in effect it will want things in a lot of ways, to perform certain tasks. It's going to, in essence, want to do things and accomplish things according to this cost function. So, I mean, I see where he was going with that.
Yeah, but he's using want as a metaphor. It won't really want anything because it's just following an algorithm. And he actually put it in air quotes himself, indicating that he understands it's just a metaphor.
Right, sure.
But the point is, what people really worry about with self-aware AI is that it will be thinking for itself in a way that really gives it the unlimited ability to come up with creative solutions that could involve killing all people, right? But the more non-self-aware, algorithm-driven, narrow AI can be on rails, you know? Doesn't mean that it won't fail in unpredictable ways. It's just that it's not going to have the launch codes for our nuclear weapons.
Right.
Yeah. It's not,
what's
the scenario in which it has the capability to somehow arrive at the conclusion in its algorithm that is going to destroy all life on Earth? I mean, that would be catastrophically irresponsible if we allowed that to happen. That's beyond lacking fail safes. Like, that's willfully reckless.
Yeah, it's evil scientist time.
Yeah, it is. And it will, I mean, I'm sure we're going to see some very creative, unanticipated solutions to some problems. But yeah, it's going to still, in many ways, still be on rails and, you know, controllable to a much, much greater degree than a completely, you know, artificial general intelligence that's like here.
So again, I do still have concerns about the vulnerabilities that are inherent in running our civilization on self-learning evolved algorithms that we don't totally understand. I get that. That's not what I'm talking. I'm just not as worried about the robot uprising as I was 20 years ago. I still think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right, Jay, before we go on with science or fiction, you have a couple of announcements.
All right, I have two conferences to tell you guys about. One of them is Nexus. Nexus is happening. Nexus 2017 is happening on June 29th to July 2nd. Leanne Lord is going to be our MC this year. She co-hosts Star Talk Radio with Neil deGrasse Tyson. And as a comedian, Leanne is sure to make the three main conference days fun as our MC. So fact number one, she won the Hilarious Housewives contest on ABC's The View.
Cool.
She was Harlem Week's official comedian for two consecutive years. She is the author of several books, including Dicked Jokes, D-I-C-T jokes.
I heard that. I got to get that.
Alternate definitions for your words you've probably never heard of, but will definitely never forget. You should also know about another conference that's going on that's being run by some of our friends on the other side of the country. This is, of course, Skeptical 2017. It's the Northern California Conference of Science and Skepticism. It will be held on Sunday, June 11th at the Shattuck Hotel Plaza and includes talks by Brian Dunning, host of Skeptoid, anthropologist Eugenie C. Scott, sex therapist Dr. Marty Klein, and many others. For tickets and more information, visit skepticalcon.com.
And also, I'm going to be in Vienna from June 7th
Austria?
To 11th. Vienna, Austria, yes. Is there another
whoa,
Vienna?
Whoa. I'm not aware. Yeah, Vienna, South Carolina. Or
no, it's Vienna. I'm giving a little science lecture there. So if there's any listeners in Vienna wow. who want to give me some of the inside scoop of what I should do while I'm there, let me know. And
Vienna,
I'm there with my wife. I can't promise I could be available for get-togethers. But you know what? Just let me know if you're going to be there. And we'll see what happens.
It won't be awkward. You'll be out to dinner with Steve and his wife on a romantic dinner.
Yeah, third like, wheel's always
who
good.
Is this guy? Yeah. Was this a podcast? NECSS.org. That's where
correct.
You go.
That's right. Okay. V-I-E-N-N-A is how you spell it. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses.
Yeah, we love the great courses, guys. If you want to learn, there's two things you should do. Well, there's a lot of things you should do. One, listen to this podcast. Two, watch the Great Courses Plus. They have got literally a vast library of so much information, so many awesome things to learn about, and probably things you're already interested in that you don't know enough about.
Yeah, I've been watching a new one called The Theory of Everything, The Quest to Explain All Reality. I'm really loving this course. Seriously, this is by Dr. Lincoln from the Fermi Lab. I love the way he's going through essentially the history of everything, you know, from a physics point of view, in a way that I really love, where it's like, this is how we built our knowledge. This is how we asked questions. This is where we are. And he's focusing on how we unify our understanding of stuff by digging deeper and deeper and deeper into the reality and showing us where we are on our quest to unify and therefore understand everything, the way the universe works. Very, very good. I'm really enjoying
neat.
It. So guys, if you're interested in this course or one of the other 8,000 that are offered on the Great Courses Plus, sign up. And as a listener of the SGU, you can watch any of them for free for a month by using our special URL, which is thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
So you could binge on knowledge.
So get your free month and you're going to love it. Sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake-a-rooney. And I challenge my panel of expert, critically thinking, scientifically literate skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Or alternatively, I'll ask you guys.
Oh, thanks.
I picked the first one.
Okay. There's no theme this week, just three news items. Are you guys ready? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. No one makes a sound.
No one. All right, here we go. Item number one. NASA data finds that terrestrial radio communications push the Van Allen belts and other high energy radiation away from the Earth and may be useful as a shield against harmful space weather. Item number two, a new study supports the hypothesis that metabolism arose prior to RNA in the origins of life on Earth. And item number three, new evidence suggests that the first mass extinction at the end of the Ordovician was caused by climate change triggered by a massive coronal mass ejection. That may be a little redundant, but you get what I'm saying. Bob, I don't believe you've gone first in a while.
All right, so we've got NASA talking smack about terrestrial radio communications pushing the Van Allen belts away from the Earth. So radio doing this. Seriously? I can't see that, especially at, you know, the intensity we're beaming into space having any type of effect on these radiation belts. So let's go to the second one. Metabolism arising prior to RNA. Yeah, I could totally buy that. Now let's go to the third one. All right, so climate change causing one of the first big mass extinctions, triggered by a CME. Wow. All right. So what would be the evidence of a coronal mass ejection that could survive that much time? Wow. I'm not sure what would be left after so many millions of years. That would be fascinating if we have evidence of a CME doing that much damage, causing an extinction. Wow. The sun could be so nasty. I just don't think the pressure from the radio communications is really going to do anything to these radiation belts. All right. I'm going to say that the terrestrial radio is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
This is interesting. Terrestrial radio communications push the Van Allen belts and other high energy radiation away from the Earth. Yeah, if that's the case, then the part about this, about using it as a shield against harmful space weather, I think sort of makes sense. If you know the right, I suppose, frequencies and amount that you need, you could theoretically send out a continual transmission and essentially create that shield that you're looking for. So I think that part of it's right. The question is it really happening? Is it really pushing the belts? To me, this one sounds plausible. The second one, metabolism arose prior to RNA. You know, a new study could support anything, I suppose. But metabolism arose prior to RNA. Gee whiz. Yeah. All right. I'm kind of believing this one as well. It's kind of leaving me alone with the last one, I suppose. The first mass extinction at the end of the Ordovician. Oh, gosh. I don't even remember how long ago that was. Did they find evidence? How did they find evidence of it? I'll say the coronal mass ejection one, climate change triggered it. Yeah, I think the coronal mass ejection part is right, but I don't think it caused maybe climate change to cause the extinction. I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay, Kara.
So that would imply then that they would be closer, because we've had terrestrial radio forever. Not really, but for as long as I've been alive, plus. So that would imply that that radiation would actually be closer if it weren't for radio. And I don't know if that is true. It's cool. I mean, it's cool if that happens to be a byproduct of this, you know, invention that nobody would have thought about that when they first put it into use. Metabolism arose prior to RNA. Vegan. Obviously, metabolism is complicated, but RNA are big. I mean, they're pretty big molecules. They're also complex molecules in the grand scheme of things. I mean, could it have happened without nucleic acids at all? Could it have happened with very simple, not even proteins, but maybe amino acids or, you know, smaller component in super simple organisms? Maybe. The first mass extinction, so that would have been with like early organisms. So this is saying that a massive coronal mass ejection actually like heated up the Earth. I don't know why that doesn't seem reasonable to me. I mean, I know that we're supposed to be, the thing about coronal mass ejections that's supposed to freak us out is that they can like fry all of our communications.
Yeah. Yep.
But not that they can like boil our oceans. So I don't know. That one seems like the fiction to me too. So I think I'm going to go with Evan.
And Jay.
Yeah, this is a hard one because I have just a lot of holes in my understanding of all these. This is so weird. Terrestrial radio communication that would actually push the Van Allen belts away from the Earth. Wow. I mean, to think that our radio transmissions could even do that. And then this last thought here to me just seems bizarre. Like it would be useful as a shield against harmful space weather. What? That doesn't seem likely at all to me. The one about the metabolism and RNA, I think that out of the three, that's the one I would say is most likely to be true. And then getting on to the a mass extinction event, climate change that was triggered by a massive coronal mass ejection. Shit, man, what would not think about that? Think about what would have to take place in order for that to significantly change climate enough to cause a mass extinction. Damn. I'm seeing what Evan is saying there. So it's like I see what Bob is saying and I see what Evan is saying. So I will go with Evan and Kara and choose the massive coronal massive mass ejection.
That's massive. That's massive.
All right. So you all agree with the second one. So we'll start there. A new study supports the hypothesis that metabolism arose prior to RNA in the origins of life on Earth. You all think this one is science. And this one... is science.
Yeah, baby.
Okay. Yay. So, in a way, it sort of makes sense. Something had to metabolize before RNA, right?
Well, actually, the predominant hypothesis at the moment is the RNA hypothesis, that RNA was the first thing that arose. So this would be new. This would be a change.
Proto-RNA.
Well, no, even before RNA, that there was metabolism, that there were chemicals and enzymes doing the basic metabolism of life, you know,
right,
without RNA. And then RNA arose later. The analysis that they're talking about here, which is, this is, you know, a little hard to wrap your head around, but I'll do my best. So they looked at the frequency of different genes in life on Earth. They're using a database that looks at all of the species that have been, where their genomes have been sequenced. But the database doesn't just list the genes and like where they are. It lists what the genes do. So you could sort them by function.
Okay.
And the idea is that the functions that arose earliest would be the most common among different species on Earth, but also those genes would have had more time to replicate, and therefore they would be the most, you know, if you follow the evolution of genes, because genes evolve too, you know, genes get duplicated, then they develop different functions, so they get duplicated again. So the longer genes have been around, the more progeny they should have spawned, right? So mm-hmm. you could look at the number of genes in a group and also how common they are across living things. And then you can organize them based upon like a tree, which ones are towards the roots and which ones are higher up. And when they did this analysis, they found that the genes that deal with basic metabolism, like generating energy, were at the base of the tree, right? They were the oldest.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and then the ones that involved, you know, managing RNA were actually later. That would be the next step up. So this is only one line of evidence.
Interesting.
It's, you know, it's, I find it interesting that you're using genes to say when genes arose, you know. So
yeah.
So I'm not really sure how that works, but, you know, by this logic, the logic of this analysis, it implies that maybe metabolism, that there were cells that were metabolizing, and then RNA became a way for them to make enzymes that would speed up the metabolism, but the metabolism came first, as opposed to, oh, here's an RNA that's reproducing itself, and then the metabolism develops in order to help it do that. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Sure.
It's going to be really hard for us to tease that apart, you know, because we're obviously trying to infer what happened almost 4 billion years ago without there being any fossil evidence or anything left behind. It's just mainly how things could have happened, just, you know, trying to infer from the way life looks today. That's really the extant species are the only fossils, if you will, that could speak to the origin of life, but it may not have captured really what was happening in those earliest stages of life developing. So
I wonder if we'll ever be able to, say, run simulations on the early Earth, and say run a million different simulations, and then say, all right, in 43% of the time, this is what happens. So this is the most likely way that things got started. But of course, that doesn't mean that a low probability event didn't occur.
Yeah.
But it'd be cool to know that this is the most likely way that this happened.
Think about that supercomputer, huh?
Yeah.
Going to simulate a planet over, 100 million years or 200 million years. That's, it's not going to be easy. Okay. But you guys are all safe so far. Let's go back to number one.
Okay.
NASA data finds that terrestrial radio communications push the Van Allen belts and other high energy radiation away from the Earth and may be useful as a shield against harmful space weather. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
I regretted that decision moments after making.
Yeah.
That was a tough one.
It was a tough one. Yeah. I mean, you had the very curious reaction I was hoping that you were going to have.
Really? I know you did.
Radio communication. All right. So there
Bob,
are.
Bob, how upset are you?
Jay, here's your stick. There's the cage with the bear in it.
There's a little bit of salt.
Bob, Jay wants to feast on your tears.
It's so good.
So there's some bits of information that I left out, Bob, that may have altered.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Evaluation. So these are very low frequency radio waves. And do you know what we use, how we use them? What kind of communication do we use very low frequency radio waves for?
AM radio.
No.
Not even radio?
Very low frequency. This is not commercial radio.
No, like, like radio dishes.
Like police? No.
Getting closer.
What? Okay. Who's military. Getting closer? Bob or Kara?
Big military. Band?
We use very low frequency radio communications to communicate with submarines because they can penetrate deep under the water.
Oh, yeah. None of us would have thought of that.
but of course, you have to use really high powered radio, very low frequency radio waves. So that's the key, is that these military, you know, installations that we're using to communicate with these submarines are putting out a ton of power.
Mm.
And when they analyzed the data from the Van Allen probe, what they noticed was, so there's literally like a bubble that these very low frequency radio waves create around the Earth.
Really?
They noticed that the Van Allen belts come right up to the edge of that bubble. That line is exactly the same. Not only that, if you look at data from like the satellites in the 1960s, the Van Allen belts used to be closer to the Earth. So it looks like this bubble of very low frequency, powerful radio waves has actually pushed the Van Allen belts away from the Earth.
That's freaking amazing.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
that's cool.
And they say that if this is true, that they would move any excess charged particles out away from the Earth, including those that result from coronal mass ejections or other, solar ejections. So we are actually influencing space weather today. So we definitely are affecting space weather. And this is now a new discovery about how these very low frequency radio waves are doing so. And they actually produce this protective bubble around the Earth that pushes away highly charged or high energy particles. So and this is not trying to do it, right? This is just trying to communicate with submarines.
Yeah,
if we try to do that, if we actually optimized the VLF transmitters, think about it. We may be able to actually protect our satellites from CMEs, theoretically. I mean, I don't think we'd have to do the math on that, but
I wonder what would it take? How many orders of magnitude more powerful would they need to be?
But that's Bob, this is like the first time I'm reading anything about like our technology being able to have that kind of influence. And it makes it seem semi-plausible that, we could protect Mars or the moon or even the Earth from solar radiation or whatever, just with our technology, just by creating really powerful radio waves,
That's interesting. It's fascinating and really cool. But impacting charged particles though is one thing, but impacting radiation electromagnetic radiation. So it's different, but charged particles are a huge problem. So yeah, impacting just charged particles would be cool.
Yeah.
That would be very, very cool.
Yeah, we could create a protective blanket for our low Earth satellites or near Earth satellites. Yeah.
So just doing that could save literally billions of dollars.
Yeah. Okay, so all of this means that new evidence suggests that the first mass extinction at the end of the Ordovician was caused by climate change triggered by a massive coronal mass ejection is the fiction. How much do you guys know about the end Ordovician extinction?
Oh my gosh.
Literally nothing. Was this before the
zero.
Cambrian explosion?
So this is just make that up?
No. So the Cambrian explosion was first.
Oh, it was first. Okay. Yeah. So this killed off a lot of the things from the Cambrian explosion.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. Because before that, how would we know, right? Because there was nothing to do.
Yeah, exactly.
was this the big boy, Steve? Like 80 to 90%? No.
This wasn't the biggest one. This was the first one. So this was 443 million years ago, the end of Ordovician, the beginning of the Silurian, which is a great name, by the way.
I like that.
Ordovician Silurian extinction event. 80% of known species went extinct at that time.
Shit, that's huge.
So you know that we have the most recent mass extinction, which is the KPG, which we just talked about, which is due mostly due to an asteroid. with some contribution from the Deccan traps. I think that's an accurate way to summarize that. The previous two, that, you know, so three and four, there were five, you know, mass extinctions. Three and four were caused by volcanism. And we don't really know what caused one and two. But now we have some evidence that suggests that maybe the first mass extinction was also volcanism.
Hmm.
And what the study showed was they found mercury in different sediments that date to that time. And mercury can be one of the things that is spewed out by volcanoes. So they found it was found in two places in North America and southern China in sedimentary rock. Seeing a mercury layer at the same geological layer on different sides of the Earth implies something big was happening. So yeah. if there was volcanic eruptions at that time enough to cover North America and China, then although I must have to think about where they are in terms of Pangaea or whatever, I'd have to look that up. But nevertheless, it still means it was pretty widespread, and that implies maybe it was another, you know, volcanic activity. So that would bring the tally to, you know, volcanic activity responsible for 1, 3, and 4, asteroid for 5, and we don't know for 2.
And we're in when we've begun 6.
And yeah, 6 is
and
just
mankind,
human beings.
Six, yeah.
Yes.
So, but you guys
so
raised
lots,
it.
Lots of volcanism. So we basically owe our existence to Vulcans.
Yeah, basically. So, but you raised an interesting question.
That's how we've lived long.
Could we know if there was a really, really big CME in the past?
Yeah.
So I didn't make this up entirely.
I asked that question, Jay.
Yeah. I didn't make this up entirely because there have been speculations that the not a mass extinction, but the more localized North American extinction that happened 12,000 years ago, 12 to 13,000 years ago at the end of the last glacial period in North America. We talked about, was that a minor comet impact or was that the melting of the glaciers and climate change?
Right.
There's one theory that maybe there was a really large CME and that triggered climate change and that was part of it. So going back thousands of years, there's two lines of evidence that could tell us about solar activity. One is tree rings, and the other is ice cores.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, right. Yep. Yes, drilling they do in Antarctica, right?
Neither of those can go back hundreds of millions of years. So I don't know of anything that could tell us that. Although there was a news report, which I think we talked about a year ago, 2 years ago, about evidence of an ancient, not coronal mass ejection, but gamma ray burst, nearby gamma ray burst. That they're saying that could theoretically have like stripped some of our atmosphere and been responsible for one of the mass extinctions, and that could have left, you know, traces behind in the soil, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could definitely see a gamma ray burst leaving much having not only leaving a better fingerprint, but actually doing the deed.
Yeah,
I mean, you remember the Carrington event from the 1800s? I mean, that was huge, but people, you know, the environment kind of shrugged it off because it's like there was no electricity, you know. So
yeah,
I'm trying to think how bad can even a worst case CME be without technology.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it would have had to be like 10 times the Carrington
event,
or whatever, 100 times.
100.
Yeah,
Jesus, 100. Yeah,
exactly. But and to be clear, there's no evidence that there was a gamma ray burst in the past. That's speculation at this point. No solid evidence for that. But that's one theory, hypothesis, I should say. Yeah. Interesting. Trying to figure out why, you know, things died in the past. Very cool. I remember, you know, that like in the 80s when the asteroid impact theory for the KPG extinction was really becoming generally accepted. That the talk at the time was maybe all 5 were due to asteroid impacts. And there was even talk about maybe like the sun passes by a nearby star every 100 million years and it kicks asteroid or kicks comets out of the Oort cloud.
Oh, yeah. Remember that?
Swarming into the Earth. And so there was something cyclical about the bombardment of the Earth. But no, it turns out not just one. That was just the only one. The rest were all volcanism. You know, we still don't know about number 2, but there's no evidence that it was an asteroid. But it's funny how we extrapolate from what we do know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Evan, do you have a quote for us this week?
Yes, I do. People tend to hold overly favorable views of their abilities in many social and intellectual domains. This overestimation occurs in part because people who are unskilled in these domains suffer a dual burden. Not only do these people reach erroneous conclusions and make unfortunate choices, but their incompetence robs them of the metacognitive ability to realize it. And that comes from the article, Unskilled and Unaware of It, How Difficulties in Recognizing One's Own Incompetence Lead to Inflated Self-Assessments. Written by Justin Kruger and David Dunning.
Yep.
We know them from the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Dunning-Kruger effect, yep.
Especially poignant in this day and age.
Absolutely.
Yeah, although I suspect Amen. It's always important, but yeah. Probably everyone, every age will say that, but
yes. Yep.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Surely, thanks, Steve. Steve.
Thanks,
you got
Steve.
It, brother.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.